painting to photography, from beadwork to woodworking. KQAL-FM on the campus of Winona State University presents Artbeat. Artbeat highlights the work and accomplishments of local artists from in and around Winona. Support for Artbeat is made possible by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Now, here's Terry Tenseth with today's Artbeat.
On this episode of Artbeat, we visit with the team behind a documentary highlighting the life and work of one of Minnesota's senators. Learn about the presidential campaign of Eugene McCarthy, which took place at a pivotal time in history during the Vietnam War. You'll hear how this project started, the process in creating a historical documentary, and plans for the film's future. I'm Terry Tenseth, and you're listening to Artbeat. Good afternoon. We are continuing our coverage from the Frozen River Film Festival with some great individuals who have made the trek all the way to Winona to talk about In the Land of Aardvarks, Gene McCarthy. Go ahead and introduce yourselves.
I am Bill Kersey, and I am directing and editing the film.
I am Kelly Green, and I am co-producer.
And I'm Mary Beth McCarthy Yarrow, and I'm executive producing. And I'm also Gene McCarthy's niece.
I was just going to say, how did this come about? But I think you just answered that question. But obviously, there is some very tight connection between you and your subject matter.
Yes, absolutely. And also, the 1968 Gene McCarthy presidential primary quite radically changed my life. I was 19, 20 years old, and I was one of those young people who, as I say, I was like Alice and jumped down the Gene McCarthy rabbit hole into political wonderland, and stretched and grew and shrunk and stretched and grew and came out of it a very changed person. As well, in the Oregon primary, I met Peter Yarrow, Peter, Paul, and Mary, and we fell in love, and we were one of the marriages that came out of the campaign as well.
I would say it changed your life.
I'd say so.
So, for each of you, when did you say we're going to start this project, and how did you start forming your team?
Well, I'm a documentary filmmaker. My first documentary film was a film called The Wilmer Eight. I grew up in Wilmer, Minnesota, and there was a story that existed there about these eight women who were working in a small bank in Wilmer who got frustrated because of economic possibilities, and these very apolitical, non-political women took action, and they brought charges against the bank at the EEOC and ultimately formed a union and went out on strike, creating the first bank strike in the history of America. And I had never experienced working in film prior, but I knew that it was an interesting story that I knew from the parallel situation with my life in the Gene McCarthy campaign and how entering into a political action in that way gives you a very different sense of self. Peter and I put in some initial money to get the film started. We made this documentary that became a very important film at that time in the area of women working, but also unionization. And that was my beginning. At a certain point, I guess it was about 1986, we were organizing a 70th birthday party for Gene McCarthy in New York, and I organized a video crew to film that event. And then in 1992, I sent out a camera woman to follow him in New Hampshire, and again in 1996. And so over 30 years have been collecting footage on him. Gene McCarthy died in December of 2005. So we are now doing a film posthumously, but we have this footage that has been gathered and collected over these years. And I came back to Minnesota to take care of my father, Jean's brother, and my mother, who lived in Willmar. And after both of them died, my time became my own again, and I felt that if this documentary story of the life and legacy of Jean McCarthy were ever going to happen, this was the time. And I was lucky enough to meet a woman, Jan Selby, who's a Minneapolis St. Paul filmmaker, and she had just worked on a project called Beyond the Divide with an editor, Bill Kersey, and I took a look at the film and at Bill's work, asked him if he would be interested in working with me on the Jean McCarthy project.
And you said yes.
Yes, I did. And here I am.
Are you a big fan of politics to begin with?
That's not how I'd put it, but I pay attention.
Okay. That's essential for your position.
I've had an interest in 68 for a while, and I grew up in Minnesota, and when I came back here a few years back, right around that time, the History Center, the Minnesota History Center was running I don't know how often they do this, maybe it was just a one-off thing, but they were doing a 1968 film festival, and people had made short films about 1968, and I was just finding my feet in town at the time and went to the event and started really thinking about that subject, became very fascinated with it. And my first point of fascination was actually Hubert Humphrey, because he was the one that gets more attention in that election. And when my path crossed with Mary Beth again, because we actually met years back in Telluride when I was a student, but her project came to my attention, and I started looking at Eugene McCarthy, I realized that that was a more fascinating story to me, that was more central to so much of what happened in that year than Humphrey's. I mean, directly. I mean, Humphrey was obviously central, but McCarthy was in a different way and more pervasively, I think, and touched on so many themes that are of interest to me. So my attention immediately shifted from Humphrey to McCarthy.
And then, Kelly, you came on.
I came on through Jan Selby as well. I have her to thank for this. I was working on distribution for Beyond the Divide, and she introduced me to Mary Beth. And I'm sort of where Mary Beth was when she started the Willmar 8. I'm in the learning process.
And that's exciting then for
Very.
You, right?
Yes.
You're just soaking it all in.
Exactly.
So
it's that wonderful school of hard knocks, you know, where you jump through the hoop of fire, and you hope that there's a net of some sort on the other side.
You make a net. That's what you do. I've been in that hoop of fire before. I understand. So what's great is you have all this footage, right? You've been collecting, which is rare, because usually you have to go in and source that out or find it, and that in itself is a process. And then you're adding in new footage that, Bill, you have to go ahead and navigate those waters, correct?
Yes.
Yeah.
The vast majority of the content is existing already, but we are shooting a few new things.
Okay. And that's primarily locally in Minnesota then, I would guess, right? There's some clips I saw at St. John's University.
Yes,
Other places.
Interviews, not necessarily in Minnesota, but non-interview footage is pretty much mostly in St. Paul and in the St. John's campus areas.
What's hard about pulling together a historical piece? What's challenging and what's rewarding?
Well, you're covering always with documentary filmmaking. You are creating the story in the editing room.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody at one of the seminars that we were at the other day asked the question, what's the difference between narrative and documentary? Because it's often easily, narrative is thrown out, and we sort of accept that people understand. But most classically, when someone talks about narrative, they're talking about a feature film, a film that has a script. The tip of sort of, or the underpinning of the iceberg is really all in the preparation. It's in the writing of the script. It's in the finding of the actors. It's in the financing. And then you take this, what you've shot, and you cut it into a movie. With documentary filmmaking, there is this vastness of information that has to be culled through, and one needs to create a treatment, a concept, a story, a kind of skeleton of sorts upon which you then try and hang what you find. And so that the creative process, I think, really comes in the editing process. You know, I will say as a compliment to Bill, and then I think it would be really interesting for him to explain it more in depth, but Bill is a very, very gifted weaver of a tapestry. And there's a sensitivity in the telling of the story that is not a classic form of documentary filmmaking. As we know, as documentary filmmaking has become more popular, mm-hmm. there are all different ways to do it. You can have Michael Moore, you know, sort of running in, and he's on camera, and it all has to do with him trying to shake something up and get an interview. There is the what we call the talking heads formula, where you interview people, and they talk, and they talk, and they talk mm-hmm. about the subject. And then there's a way in which Bill edits and creates a story. And it has, you know, a very internal quality to it, with a sensitivity and a sensibility, which I think calls upon one to pay careful attention. And with a subject as deep and as complex as Gene McCarthy is, I feel very, very, very grateful to have Bill as the director editor on this film to sort of bring that story to light.
How do you feel about the whole process of you putting together everything? I mean, because you know this story. It's historical.
Well, it's a big story.
Yeah.
And there's plenty to learn for me still. And the process for me is one that it's a carefully considered process. And I mean that to be descriptive. I'm not trying to praise it. But and it could be argued that sometimes you can be too carefully considered in it, where you end up just getting paralyzed with the options that are in front of you. And I think it may affect the way my brain actually works, which is why a format like this, where you know, it's live, it's in the moment, and you do it, and that's it. It's sort of is really outside of my wheelhouse. So I'll do the best I can here. You know, I'm used to working in a cave and putzing around until I get it just right and then unveiling it. So if I look like a deer in the headlights when you ask a question at times, it may be because of that. But it is a process where I do spend a lot of time trying to make it more than just an academic piece,
right,
of information or of storytelling, and more than storytelling. I mean, I think sometimes I've been accused, in not these words, but of being a bit thematically overambitious. I love to try to find the connections between things. These can be forced sometimes, so I think it's, you know, incumbent upon me to be very careful that they're authentic and organic, but to find the connections between the different parts of the story that reinforce or sometimes contradict other parts of the story, and that will allow the viewer to look at it perhaps in ways they hadn't considered it before if they're unfamiliar with it, and perhaps in ways that are more interesting than if it's just a straightforward historical retelling if they're hearing about some of the stuff for the first time, and especially in ways that will allow them to see the connections to other things that are contemporary or universal, or are things that really bring it from something that's in the past, that's history bound, to something that's relevant and meaningful today.
And that's really important, the whole universal appeal thing, because you don't want to limit your audience. You want everybody to feel comfortable while they're watching the film and get the information you want, but still be motivating in some context.
Comfortable in not being lost and alienated in the story. I think it's good to not comfort them necessarily in the messages that they're getting, but to challenge them to look at things from a different perspective in a way that perhaps they hadn't considered. So in that sense, I'm not a confrontational guy, and I'm not a confrontational filmmaker, so I don't want to overstate that, but that's just why I'm sort of going after that word comfortable there.
Makes sense. And then, Kelly, as a producer on this, you're giving feedback.
No.
No?
No, not really.
Tell me what you're doing.
No, I do a little bit more behind the scenes sort of thing. So research, grant writing, web development, administrative, things like that.
Wow, you kind of got a whole other wheelhouse going on there. So what has been challenging and a learning experience for you during this process?
Well, you know, I'm somebody who has not been in the film arena at all. So it's all interesting. It's all challenging because a lot of it is new. But I'm learning that you can learn so much from watching films. And I think sometimes Bill has said my feedback, if I do give it, is interesting to him because I haven't watched a lot of films. So it's completely fresh, I guess.
New set of eyes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you're able to give that. And the grant writing process is really important, too. I mean, how much of this was grant funded for y'all?
Well, we're still waiting for some.
Oh, okay.
So.
Yeah. I know that game.
Yeah.
What you saw, I think, or what I sent to you, and what we will play this afternoon at the film festival is an 11-minute piece that was put together early on in the project so that we really wanted to use it as a fundraising tool,
right?
A development reel that would give people a sense of the elements that were available, the man, because for many people they still confuse him with Joe McCarthy.
Right.
And also to give a sense of Bill's craft, so that although this is a 10 or 11 minute piece, it is constructed with a movement and with an arc and with newspaper footage. It's articles. It's a pastiche of what's to come. And so we have a big job still ahead of us of really getting full funding and moving forward. We are very, very grateful to Crystal Hagee and to the Winona Film Festival. I was introduced to Crystal at Telluride Mountain Film through Beth and George Gage last year. And Crystal said, oh, please come. We'd like to in some way figure out a way that we can work with you to shepherd this film. And my former husband, as I mentioned, is Peter, Paul, and Mary. And Peter offered to do a benefit concert here at Winona, which happened last November. And half of the proceeds would go to the film festival and half of it would come to our project. And so that created, you know, some interest for the film, and then it was invited to come back as a work in progress, because that is something that Crystal feels is very important for people who are interested in film, not just to see them as completed films, but to be able to say, oh my goodness, these are, you know, this is a process. And with Massacre River yesterday, we saw a different work in progress that was quite fascinating. But this is really, we call it a development reel. It's not even a trailer, because a trailer really speaks more to a shortened version of the completed film. This is a pre-trailer. This is a shortened version of what we hope to grow.
How big do you expect the piece to be, and where do you want it to go?
I think the story requires a feature length, which is in the 81-minute version. And we have very recently been encouraged by national broadcasters, because 2018 is the 50th anniversary of 1968. And for those who are listening who may be too young to know, it was one of the most tempestuous years in this last century. The Vietnam War was in full...
It was going on.
Engaged.
Yeah.
It had been 64, 65, 66. And there was a strong anti-war movement that was growing in this country that wanted the war to end, and they were looking for a candidate. And sort of Gene McCarthy was not the first candidate. They were really hoping that Robert Kennedy seemed to be the person that they felt. And Robert Kennedy said no, he couldn't, he wouldn't, didn't feel it was a right time to do it, because at the time Lyndon Johnson was the sitting president and he was the incumbent Democratic Party president, so that by all rights he was the heir apparent to the nomination and should have been able to be reelected. But when Gene felt that the issue of the war needed to be taken to the American people and decided to enter some of the early primaries, he had an unexpected showing in New Hampshire where they thought he would get 12% of the vote if he were lucky, and ended up getting 42%. And I think when they counted the absentee ballots, he may have even gotten a larger percentage than Lyndon Johnson. So it forced, not forced, Lyndon Johnson made the decision that he would not run, he would not seek the nomination of his party, which left room for Robert Kennedy to then enter the race. Hubert Humphrey, who was Lyndon Johnson's vice president, became the Democratic candidate, but he decided not to enter any of the primaries. There was no reason to, because the party loyals sort of had a handle on all of that. So the primaries of 1968 came between the peace candidates, the anti-war candidates of Robert Kennedy and Gene McCarthy. And Gene won New Hampshire, and then Robert Kennedy went on to win Indiana and Nebraska. Gene won in Oregon. But in that year, that April, Martin Luther King was assassinated, and we had the riots in the cities after his murder. And then in June of that year, after Robert Kennedy narrowly beat Gene McCarthy in the California primary, was the year that he was gunned down, the night that he was gunned down. So we had both of those assassinations. Then we moved into Chicago and the Chicago Convention, where there were literally police riots in the streets, that there was a large numbers of anti-war protesters, the yippies, the yuppies, who came to the streets of Chicago, and there was really a bloodbath. At the same time, the Russians were marching into Prague, and Hubert Humphrey was given the nomination. He lost to Richard Nixon, the Republican candidate, in that election, and Richard Nixon escalated the war in Vietnam and moved it into Laos and Cambodia, and another 25,000 American soldiers lost lives, and another million North and South Vietnamese. So it's a very big year. And
it's huge, yeah.
This is a very shaggy dog way of saying what we hope is that we have some interest in looking at public television or cable broadcasters who, if we can get the project finished in time, might look at the Gene McCarthy story as a national broadcast this year of 2018, almost, I think, more than any other year prior to it. I think Gene is looked at as a Minnesota favorite son kind of story, and he's often overlooked and sidelined in terms of the importance that he played in 1968, but even that he played in changing sort of the much of
the landscape.
The landscape, yeah. Exactly.
So there is a deadline in mind then for that, for the year, for 2018.
Well, we're giving ourselves December 2017 so that it's ready for broadcasters, and that's a big challenge. One of the things that's been unearthed, Terry, that's very exciting, but also is requiring us to raise additional funding for, is that the 1968 media campaign was all carefully chronicled and given to Georgetown University in Washington, D.C. When Elmer L. Anderson opened the Elmer L. Anderson Library at the University of Minnesota, he and Gene had been lifelong friends, and they both wanted the collection to come to Minnesota. So that entire collection was moved from Georgetown University, and it is now housed in the McCarthy Collection at the Elmer L. Anderson Library. However, a great deal of it is in 2-inch broadcast tape, which is what was used at the time.
Yeah.
and it is unseeable, unviewable, and consequently inaccessible. And so we have been spending time trying to find even a machine in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area where we could look at some of this and make selections. But what we're realizing is that the entire collection really needs to be sent to a proper digitizing house, so the tape can all be baked, the material can then be transferred. Plus, there's a, we keep using the word treasure trove. In 1968 and 69, Emile D'Antonio made a documentary called America is Hard to See, which focused on the Jean McCarthy story. So there are tins of picture and track, 16 millimeter, that are sitting on the shelves, shot by the legendary Maisels brothers and with interviews of really interesting people. But again, to even find a Steenbeck so we could look at this material, and it's brittle, so you have to be careful with it. So we are on the hunt for people who are interested, or grant foundation people who would give us money to have this entire archive transferred so that we can lift excerpts of it, but historians, students,
other
really
people
have
benefit
access to it.
And that's expensive work because it has to be handled in a very specific way. And then there's the equipment for that. So I know they charge a premium for those services.
To do the whole collection, it would be close to $98,000.
Yeah, that's a lot of money.
Yeah. But again, to that end, we have, through Crystal and through coming to Winona, the Winona Arts Board has offered to write a legacy grant on our behalf to try and get some of this material transferred, but also to help down the line find some money to put a traveling study guide together that that we can make a curriculum that would go with the film when finished, and can go into high schools and colleges and talk about things like public policy, civic engagement.
Well, you can learn a lot from the past.
Exactly. Yeah. The kinds of things that sort of are seem very absent from the political landscape of today, considered thought.
Bill, for you, looking at all this footage from the past, sometimes as an editor, it can feel kind of overwhelming as to where to dig and where to start. How do you begin to process?
Yeah, this one's a particular challenge.
Yeah.
I've edited several documentaries before, and it's ranged from a fair amount of material to a really lot of material.
Like too much?
This one is kind of the first bottomless pit of material, because it's such a public story. There's so much historical material out there that it is overwhelming. And with so much of it inaccessible. You know, that's a challenge I haven't had to deal with in the past either. I'm used to the metaphor that I've used in the past to describe some of the first stages of the editing process is when you first are starting out to do a jigsaw puzzle and you just dump the box on the table and you just go through turning over the pieces to see what's there, and maybe start, you know, here to put the blue pieces for the sky over in this part of the table, and here are the edges over here. And you can't really do that with this, because it would be like doing that, and then you get a little ways through that process, and somebody comes along and hands you another box of pieces. There's just no end to it.
So right, that, and then you have to change everything, right?
Yeah. It's those game changers that start scaring you. You know, it's like, am I overlooking something that's going to come in and undo my paradigm that I'm starting to follow to put this together? So really, I mean, the answer to that isn't to fear that change. The answer to that is to really think broadly and strategically to try to come up with a paradigm that can accommodate your best understanding of what you think you might find in some of those, you know, inaccessible sources that you may get access to down the road.
Yeah, it can be, sometimes when we're given too much, it's really hard to even know where to start. So
yeah.
I can sympathize with that.
And if you can start developing a paradigm, which is another story in itself, but if you can, then when new stuff comes in and you can kind of apply a method to examining it, to be able to go through it and to see it as a sea of opportunities and not just more stuff to mess with your head.
Right.
And I think that's very doable. You know, and this is just the initial stages. I mean, this doesn't even really tackle the questions of how to start really pulling it together into a story that does what you need it to do. This is just, well, I mean, it's the first stages of that, finding that paradigm.
It's exciting.
It is, yeah. I mean, going along with that stress of, oh, there's this stuff out there that I feel like I need to know because it's going to affect my plans.
Right.
The correlation to that is it's just a constant stream of incredible discoveries that just the light bulbs go off, and you know, you just have to start writing page after page of notes so that you make sure you keep track of them all.
Or audio notes, or yeah. Otherwise, yeah. I'm sure you've probably woken up in the middle of the night and jotted things down too.
Yes,
because that's kind of how the creative mind works, right? If we don't write it down,
yep.
God forbid.
You won't remember that you forgot something.
You keep the journal by the bed, wake up, turn over. Right. Go back to sleep. So if people want to find out more information about the project, have inquiries, or want to know how to contribute in some way, what's the best way to get a hold of you? Is it through the website, Kelly? Or?
Well, the full website is still under production, but we do have a dedicated web page, and the URL is www.mccarthyfilm.com, and there is instructions on how to donate right there. And the website itself will be up in March.
Any Facebook presence or social media presence at this time?
We do have a Facebook page and a Twitter page, although we're not broadcasting a lot on it right at the moment. But again, that's going to change in March because we may start a crowdfunding campaign in March as well.
Good luck with that. Yeah.
Thank you. So McCarthyfilm.com would be the place to go.
And we have through the IFP Minnesota, the Film Board in Minnesota, we have been accepted as a fiscal sponsor. So donating can be done as a 501c3 and is tax deductible if people wish to go that route. And they also have a web page for us. But the easiest place to go, I think, is McCarthyfilm.com or IFP Minnesota. And then you actually look for Gene McCarthy, right.
Yeah.
The Gene McCarthy Project, right.
Mm. Again, it's Gene McCarthy in the land of aardvarks. Thank you for joining us today. And I look forward to maybe getting an update on how the project goes.
Great.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much, Terry.
Welcome.
Thanks again to Mary Beth Yarrow, Bill Kersey, and Kelly Green for visiting with us on ArtBeat. More information on the documentary Gene McCarthy in the Land of Aardvarks can be found on Facebook by searching Land of Aardvarks and www.mccarthyfilm.com. I'm Terry Tensett, thanking you for listening to ArtBeat.
ArtBeat is written and produced by KQAL-FM on the campus of Winona State University. Visit us on the web at kqal.org.